Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. How much do we overestimate ourselves, and how mistaken can we be? Take the case of Jennifer Thompson, who spoke to 60 Minutes in 2009 about being raped as a college student in 1984.
I remember kind of waking up and turning my head to the side and saying, "Who's there? Who is it?" And I saw the top of someone's head kind of sliding beside my mattress. And I screamed, and I felt a blade go to my throat.
Thompson remembered the face of her attacker, and she positively identified him in court. But as it turned out, she was wrong about the man who raped her and who she helped convict, as DNA evidence later showed.
I looked at him and I said, "Ron, if I spent every second of every minute, every hour for the rest of my life telling you how sorry I am, it wouldn't come close to how my heart feels. I'm so sorry."
My guest, Chris Chabris, argues that we often overestimate or really wrongly assess our abilities in many areas of life. Chris Chabris is the co-author of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Chris Chabris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with that question of eyewitness testimony. I feel like people think about Perry Mason or they think about Matlock, and that the notion that the person in the witness stand points to the guy in the courtroom and says, "That was the guy." I mean, that is sort of the most ironclad kind of testimony you can get, where you have like a real eyewitness who saw the crime happen.
It feels like the most ironclad and the best testimony you can have. People do put a lot of stock in eyewitnesses, and I think the fact that we believe them so much illustrates this illusion we have about how memory works. The assumption that our minds seem to make, and it's not a conscious decision we come to, it's sort of just an assumption we all make, is that memory works better than it really does, that people's recollections of things are more accurate, precise, detailed, objective, and long-lasting than they really are. And as a result, when someone gets up and recites a memory, and especially if they do it very confidently, if they don't say anything about being uncertain or unsure, the tendency of jurors and other people involved, investigators, police, judges, and so on, is to take that evidence entirely at face value. It's not cross-examined often in the way that maybe it should be to reveal its true value. And as Jennifer Thompson's case shows, confident eyewitness testimony can often lead us horribly astray.
And I know, I don't know if it happens anymore, but I know in law schools it used to be sort of a classic example that, you know, somebody would run into a classroom and like steal a book, and then they would say, "What color shirt was that person wearing?" And people would be like, "Blue." And other people would be like, "No, that was definitely yellow, and he had blonde hair, and he had..." And that is an effort, right, to try to get people to see the sort of the problem of eyewitnesses.
Right. That's a classic experiment and a classic classroom demonstration that's used in law schools and psychology classes, and probably should be done more often, because it brings the students face to face with the fallibility of their own memory. And it's not their own memory for what happened years ago or for some subtle detail of something that's not relevant or important. It's a crime, at least as far as they know it's a crime. They don't know it's staged. They think it's a crime that happened right in front of their eyes, you know, 2 minutes ago, anything like the passage of time. Even before the police start to interview the witnesses, more time has passed than 2 minutes. So if it can be that bad and you can have that much of a Rashomon-like experience where some people saw a red shirt and some people saw a green shirt and so on within that short period of time, it should highlight for us how tenuous memories can be in the criminal justice system at large.
So, I mean, so you've written this book about how our intuitions deceive us. How do you explain that? How do you explain if somebody runs into a room, steals a book, and is wearing a red shirt, how is it possible that smart people in law school are watching that happen and people disagree about the color shirt and the color hair and the color eyes and the height? How is that possible?
Well, it's good that you mentioned smart people, because I don't think this has much to do with intelligence. So the illusion of memory, which we're talking about right now, and the other illusions that Dan Simons and I talk about in our book, we argue are things that result from sort of structural features of the way the mind is designed. The way evolution has designed the human mind result in these things automatically. Now, we can think about them, study them, become smarter about them, and maybe change the way we act. But this is sort of the default way that the mind works. And smart people and less smart people, it works the same. It works the same way. I think there are sort of two interesting things going on here. One, our memories don't record as much, you know, a lot of stuff. So they don't seem to record a lot of details. But two, we're surprised by that because we think they've recorded all those details accurately. So there are two things happening. One, fallibility of memory, and two, our lack of insight into the fallibility of our own memory. So if you had only one and not the other, we might be okay. If everybody knew that memory wasn't as great as we think it is, then we could adjust accordingly and maybe put more weight on other kinds of evidence or look for multiple witnesses who all agree or things like that. But as long as we make that mistake of thinking memory is working better than it really is, we're going to do things like wind up believing that one confident eyewitness is enough to convict someone of a crime. Dan and I, for the book, did a survey where we actually asked a representative sample of the American public if they agreed that one confident eyewitness should be enough to convict people of a crime. And a substantial percentage of people did, I think about 35 or 40%. So if your jury is filled with those people, they might wind up convicting someone who's not actually guilty.
And Jennifer Thompson, who I mentioned, who was raped in 1984, absolutely convinced that the person she thought did it, did it. He didn't. And the amazing thing was she had actually come into contact after the rape with the person who did do it. And because she just remembered a different face than, I guess, you know, was the actual rapist, no alarm bells were set off. She felt nothing when she saw the guy who was the actual perpetrator.
So that's a fantastic case, by the way, and I recommend the book that she and Ronald Cotton wrote themselves. They wrote a joint memoir of it for a lot more details.
And I should say Ronald Cotton is the person who was wrongly accused, who she ended up apologizing to.
Yes, she ended up apologizing to, and now, amazingly, they're friends and they go on speaking tours, and I met them both, and they seem like great people, and they wrote a great book. One fascinating thing about her case is that she did make a conscious effort during this horrible experience to encode in her memory as many details as she could so that if she survived, she would be able to be a great witness later on for the police. And the investigators told her throughout the case from the beginning to the end, to the trial and conviction, that she was a model witness and she did everything right and so on, which made it all the more devastating for her to find out that, you know, that she had made a mistake, essentially, that it was her fault, you know, in some sense, that the wrong guy was in prison for years and years. Once she made the first identification, I believe it was a photo array of potential suspects. Interestingly, memories change as we recall them. So when she first recalled the image of Ronald Cotton's face, it might not have perfectly matched any of those people there. But when she found the one that was closest, of course, it was not his image. It was the real rapist whose image was in her mind. But once she recalled that image and then matched it with Ronald Cotton's face, that sort of changes the memory. So as she goes on and on in the process to a physical lineup and then to the confrontation in court and so on, the memory essentially becomes one of the wrong person. And it's not like she can suddenly snap out of it and say, oh, yeah, it's that other guy. Even seeing the other guy in court, she said, nope, that's not the guy. I've never seen him before in my life. That's what you're referring to, I think. Because at that point, the memory had become changed. And she didn't realize that. Memories change, and we don't realize that they change.
So just one more question about this law school example. So, you know, the guy runs into the room, and people disagree on what shirt he's wearing and what his hair color is and stuff. I wonder, is part of that because people are watching a lecture and they don't realize that somebody's about to come in and steal a book? If they did know, if the law school professor said, now everybody pay close attention, somebody's going to run in here and steal something, I want you to, you know, keep your eye out for him, would they be a lot? Is it because they're not focused, but if they did focus, they would remember, or they would be just as, you know, bad?
Well, if you know there's going to be a test later on and you're supposed to memorize stuff for the test, you're likely to do better than if not. So that's the difference between deliberate memory encoding and what's sometimes called incidental encoding. Incidental is just the things you happen to store in memory, you know, during an experience. Studies have found that often when people are involved in crimes themselves as victims, let's say, they tend to not look at the perpetrator's face as much as they think they do. Instead, they look at things like the weapon and other things. Of course, if they don't realize this, they might still think they got a good impression of people's face. Once again, because we overestimate our memory abilities. So it doesn't really surprise me in retrospect now that these law school demos work the way they do. But it surprises everyone going in because they think they're going to remember those kind of things much better than they do. I hope that repeating that demo over and over again in law school classes sort of seeps in more into the legal system.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about there was a famous case in Boston that you talk about in the book of eyewitnesses really seeming to totally fail in giving testimony for a case. And what it was is this police officer named Michael Cox is beat up. And police people are there around it, but they don't seem to see it. So talk a little bit about that case.
This is the case that we talk about at the beginning of the book, and it's a fascinating story. In 1995, there was a shooting in downtown Boston at a hamburger restaurant, and the suspects fled in a stolen car, and the announcement went out on the police radio about what had happened. And interestingly, there was a mistake in that the radio announcement said that a cop had been one of the shooting victims. So many police officers joined in the pursuit. There were maybe 15 cars chasing this stolen car around in downtown Boston at 2 a.m. Finally, after this high-speed chase, the car stops in a cul-de-sac. It basically gets stuck at a dead end. The suspects jump out and run away. Michael Cox was in the first car on the scene, the first one following the stolen car. And he chased one of the suspects over the chain-link fence at the end of the cul-de-sac. And the suspect went over the fence. As Cox is climbing the fence, he got struck from behind and knocked down. And then he was beaten up fairly brutally. And it turns out he was beaten up by other police officers. And the reason why they did it, well, I don't know exactly the reason why they did it, but I think a logical conclusion is that Cox was in plain clothes that night. He was black. The suspects were all black. It was dark. It was a dead-end cul-de-sac, and there was initially a case of mistaken identity. Once they realized that he was a cop, someone said, hey, he's a cop, then the people beating him up ran away. And nobody admitted responsibility for this accidental incident of brutality. Of course, they shouldn't be beating people up like that anyhow, but at least someone should have come forward. So although the original crime was solved, all those suspects were caught, the investigators trying to figure out what happened to Cox were kind of stymied because no one would say that they did it. No one would say they saw who did it. And where the science comes in is what happened when the investigators found an officer who really should have been in the best position to see what happened, because this guy named Kenny Conley, who was at the time a uniformed officer, had arrived in one of the later cars, but he saw the suspect who had gone over the fence that Cox had been initially chasing. So Conley took up the pursuit of this suspect, and he ran to the fence, scaled it, climbed over, followed him for a mile, and apprehended him at gunpoint and brought him back. And it was Conley who the investigators focused on and said, did you see what happened to Cox? Did you see who beat him up? Conley continued to maintain that he didn't see anything, that he didn't see Cox, he didn't see any plainclothes officers, he didn't see any beating. All I saw was what I was chasing. Investigators couldn't believe it, and he was eventually indicted for perjury and obstruction of justice because they couldn't believe that he could be telling the truth about that. He was right there, he followed the same guy, and he was convicted and sentenced to 34 months for perjury and obstruction of justice and fired from the police force. That's the case that we talk about because we think there is another explanation for what was going on. It's not a case of eyewitness memory, really. It's not a question of having seen something and forgotten. It's a question of whether he really actually saw it at all in the first place.
And it's a question kind of also of what you see versus what you expect to see, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and what you and whether looking at something or having it within your field of view is actually the same as seeing it. I think the investigators and the jurors, in fact, and everybody involved in the case said Conley was there. He was in the place. He was in the area where he should have seen it. He had to have been looking in that direction where this beating happened because he chased the same guy who Cox was chasing, and they could not believe that he could have looked in that direction and been nearby and not seen it. And even Conley himself said, yeah, if that happened, I should have seen it. I was there. He didn't, he in his own testimony sort of implicated himself, at least in being in position to see it. He just continued to maintain that he didn't see it. He couldn't explain why he didn't see it. He said, I should have seen it, but I didn't. And that was sort of found to be not credible. And I think the reason why it was found to be not credible is that intuitively we think that if you're around something and you look in that direction, you must have seen it. But it turns out that's not the way the visual parts of our brain actually work.
We're talking to Chris Chabris, co-author of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. We're talking about our brains and how they can often lead us astray from what we see to how we think about ourselves. And Chris Chabris, I think the Boston case, the Michael Cox case, leads really well into the invisible gorilla experiment and the issue of, is what we see in front of us all there is to see?
That's the assumption that we make is that what we do see is everything we could have seen in a sense. And the reason why we talk about the Conley and Cox case in our book is that what happened to Conley, if he's telling the truth, is strikingly similar to what happened to subjects in an experiment that Dan and I did at Harvard a number of years ago. In fact, the experiment was conducted sort of while the Conley case was going on, although we didn't know anything about it. We hadn't been following it in the newspapers.
And it's become a really famous and well-known experiment since with the gorilla experiment that you're about to talk
about.
Yes,
you can see it on YouTube, and it's been, it's gotten somewhat popular. I think partly because it involves a gorilla. Gorillas are sort of inherently funny. Actually, the experiment was based on something done by Ulrich Neisser, who was one of the pioneering cognitive psychologists in the 1970s. He had had a woman carrying an umbrella in his experiment, and we were inspired by that to do something similar. And the experiment is very simple. Participants watch a video, and in the video, there are six people, three wearing white shirts and three wearing black shirts. The white-shirted people have their own basketball. The black-shirted people have their own basketball. And the viewer's task is just to pay attention to what the white-shirted people do and count the number of times they throw their ball. Keep a silent count in your head, sort of to make it a mentally challenging task. And at the end of the video, we ask people how many times they passed the ball. How many passes did they count? And then we ask them, did they notice anything else unusual? And it turns out that there is a gorilla walking across the screen about halfway through the video. And we had obviously inserted that deliberately in the video. And the interesting thing is about half the people don't notice it at all. They don't notice it. They don't remember it. To them, it's as though it wasn't there at all. And this demonstrates a phenomenon called inattentional blindness. The idea is that if you're not paying attention to something, it can be as though you're blind to it. The people who didn't see it were just as good at counting the passes as the people who did see it. And the people who didn't see it were surprised that it was there. People who do see it are surprised that anyone could miss it.
Yeah, so, I took this experiment, totally didn't see the gorilla.
So perhaps, and it's nothing to be ashamed about because it's not related at all to intelligence or amount of education you've had or personality. We haven't been able to find any real solid differences between people who notice it and people who don't. It's probably just luck. It's some random factors that can't really be predicted just based on knowing something about the person. Maybe what happened to Conley was that Conley was so focused on the suspect that he was chasing, making sure that he paid attention to where he was going, making sure the guy didn't pull out a gun or throw away evidence or something like that, that he really did not see anything else that was going on around there. He claimed in the trial that it was something like tunnel vision. Tunnel vision may be sort of like a colloquial way we think about inattentional blindness. And unfortunately, our experiment played no role in his case, but he did manage to get his conviction overturned because of the way the prosecution handled evidence, and he was not retried. So he got back on the police force, but basically 10 years later after this incident. It took that long before he got back on the police force, and he's now there today.
You also have an experiment that I think people can actually do themselves, and you have a bunch of researchers who you ask, where were you on 9/11? Like, how did you find out that the World Trade Center was attacked? Write me your account of how this happened. And they are three psychologists, right? And they really can't agree. They were all together. Well, they differ on that, too. But it's this very interesting thing where everybody has sort of a slightly different take on who was there, who told them.
Well, in the case of 9/11, it's a great example because everyone has a memory of where they were that day and how they heard the news. And
very strong memory, generally.
Right. Yeah,
very
not just
powerful.
A memory, right? Yeah,
that's
not just
right.
A memory like they know what they had for dinner last night, but a strong memory that they're very confident in. And what Dan Simons did while we were working on the book was he wrote down his own memory of how he learned about it, and then he emailed all the people who he thought were there with him and asked for their memories without telling them what his own memory was. So he was able to compare their independent recollections. And it turned out he was wrong about two of the people. They weren't even there. They were somewhere else. And there was another person who was there who Dan had forgotten about. And studies have looked at this, have found that memories of important, you know, even traumatic events like 9/11 change over time just as much as memories of ordinary events. But what doesn't change over time is our confidence in those memories. So we're just as confident 3 years later that we know exactly what went on, but we're just actually as inaccurate as we would be about what happened the day before 9/11 or the day after 9/11.
And people transplant other people into the memories. They change all sorts of things about the memories, but like you
yes.
said, they're totally confident of them.
And this is going on all the time. And one time it really comes to public attention is when politicians screw up and claim to have been somewhere where they weren't or claim to have done something that they didn't. Hillary Clinton claiming to have been under sniper fire in Bosnia is one of the most famous examples.
Let me stop you there. We have a clip from a 2008 report from CBS about Hillary Clinton's memory of visiting war-torn Bosnia in 1996. And as you say, this became sort of emblematic of her being really dishonest about what she remembered. Let's listen to that report.
It was supposed to be an example of Hillary Clinton's battle-tested experience. I remember landing under sniper fire.
In the speech last week, Senator Clinton was referring to her visit to Tuzla, Bosnia in 1996 as First Lady. The brutal war was over, but hostilities continued. And though the trip was exactly 12 years ago tomorrow, the memory seemed etched in Clinton's mind.
There was supposed to be some kind of a greeting ceremony at the airport, but instead we just ran with our heads down to get into the vehicles to get to our base.
Problem is, that's not what happened.
And Chris Shebri, the author of The Invisible Guerrilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us, you say it maybe was not that Hillary Clinton was just putting a false story out there.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I should preface this by saying is that in the examples we talk about in the book, Kenny Conley is one of them, Jennifer Thompson, Hillary Clinton, we're not such good psychologists that we can get inside their minds and figure out exactly what happened and exactly what they were thinking. So it is possible that she was deliberately lying. And in fact, that's the way a lot of the media portrayed it at the time, that she was on the cover of the New Republic with the slogan, "The voice is in her head," as though she was some kind of crazy person, you know, or a compulsive liar and so on. You know, that's theoretically possible, but the explanation that no one really thought about in that entire episode is that this was an ordinary false memory that was created by combining multiple sources of information. There was sniper fire in Bosnia. It was dangerous. She did go there. There was a war. People, you know, were shot at and so on. She combined all that stuff probably with the goals and self image that she had at the time. She was trying to draw this distinction on the basis of who had more experience and who had more, especially in foreign policy. And that all just resulted in a recollection of something that didn't happen. And, you know, of course, this is not good. We'd rather people didn't do that. But I think all of us do the same thing, probably to about the same degree. It's just that we don't have CBS News following us around, filming what we do and then pulling out the archival footage. But if you were going around with your, you know, your friend or your spouse or something like that, and you said, hey, you know, 3 months ago, I told you X, and that person was able to whip out like a video, you know, a cell phone video. No, here's that conversation we had, and
right.
As you'll see, it's completely different. We would find ourselves caught in that way, you know, just as often as politicians are.
Which we see happen all the time. People say that happened at last Thanksgiving, and somebody will say, no, that happened at Christmas. You don't know what you're talking about. And
yeah.
Our own family memories conflict. Actually,
yeah.
You have a great Patrick Stewart story that you heard from a friend. So tell us that story.
Yeah, so Dan Simons, my co-author for the book, had hosted a party, and I was there, and a friend of ours named Ken was there. And Ken told this great story about how he had sat next to Patrick Stewart, who played Captain Picard on Star Trek and was in X-Men and various other movies. He sat next to him at Legal Seafood, actually, in Kendall Square. And Patrick Stewart was there, and he was there with a young female companion, and they had ordered baked Alaska for dessert, which is an unusual dessert. You hardly ever see it on the menu. And some of the cooks had come out from back and asked him for an autograph, and then the manager came and apologized and so on. And then Patrick Stewart didn't seem to mind at all. He was cheery about it, and they got up and left to go on with their evening. And so Ken's telling this whole story. And at the end of the story, I said, well, that's really a wonderful story, Ken, except for one problem. That actually happened to me. I was the one who sat next to Patrick Stewart in Legal Seafood, and I must have told you about it. And even funnier was that Ken sort of thought about it for a second and then immediately realized that, in fact, he had been telling my story. And had, you know, I don't know how many other times he had peddled that story and, you know, how many other people he'd impressed by sitting next to Captain Picard. The biggest irony of the whole thing, though, is that Ken and I were both in graduate school at the time. Ken was in a lab where the topic of study was false memory. And yet he himself, you know, was no different from anyone else.
But he believed that he sat next to Patrick Stewart at Legal Seafoods.
Up until I reminded him that he hadn't. He honestly believed that. I don't think he was consciously trying to carry out some kind of con. If he was, he was being much more stupid about it than, you know, you would expect to do it right to my face. Then he just happened to get caught by someone who was there. Generally speaking, when two people are fighting over who remembers something better, though, it doesn't always work out that way, that someone says, well, that happened to me, not you. And these are bad arguments to have because both sides are probably overconfident in their memory. The truth is probably somewhere in between. And that's one of the things that happens with memory. If memories change over time, then both people's memories will diverge from, you know, the true facts of what actually happened. And then the argument becomes even more pointless because no one can possibly win and be right.
Yet you also talk about some sort of famous overconfidence with people who are professionals and their job is to make things make sense. And you talk about famous scenes, for example, in Pretty Woman, where Julia Roberts is having breakfast with Richard Gere, kind of a famous scene in the hotel, and she picks up a croissant. but she ends up taking a bite out of a pancake. And people very often don't even realize that somebody in the shots just completely messed up. And then there's another great example you give of Saving Private Ryan, where eight men go walking across a field. And one of the men was killed a few minutes earlier, but the filmmakers, or Steven Spielberg, a genius, must not have realized, we killed that guy.
Yeah, those are called continuity errors. And the funny thing about continuity errors is that actually we almost never notice them. So movies are actually littered with continuity errors. And if you go to any data, just, you know, type in continuity errors in Google and you'll get databases that list, you know, dozens of them. My favorite movie, The Godfather, has all kinds of continuity errors in it. The funny thing about them is that once you see them, they look so obvious and you can't look away. You see it every time. But until you see them, you would never notice them. And so that leads to this experience of thinking, how could Steven Spielberg or how could these highly paid film editors and directors and so on miss these things? Again, it's the illusion of memory. It's the idea that we think that we should be remembering things from moment to moment much more accurately than we really are. It turns out it's hard to remember those things, and it's even hard for the people who do the job to remember those things. The people who do the job on the set of recording, you know, was it a pancake or a croissant in Julia Roberts' hand so they can do it right for the next shot, they've sort of learned not to trust their memory, and they've learned to write things down and sort of what the limits of their own abilities are by repeated experience to their own memory failures, repeated exposure. That's the kind of learning that would be nice for us all to go through, and then maybe be a little less overconfident in our memories when we actually have to recall them.
I want to talk about another incidence of sort of overconfidence, the sort of general area that you talk about, where people believe themselves generally to be above average and underestimated, so that you have many more than 50% of people saying, this is, you, I think you call this the Lake Wobegon effect, where everybody believes themselves to be above average, which is, of course, statistically impossible.
I wish I could take credit for that phrase, but that's been going around and for a while, the idea that everybody can't be above average, except in Lake Wobegon, where everybody is above average. The typical result when people have surveyed the public on questions like, are you more intelligent than the average person? Are you a better driver than the average person? And so on. Even, professors were surveyed and asked, are you better than the average professor? I believe in that case, 94% said yes, which is even more than the number of people who say they're better than average in intelligence, which is maybe more like 70 or so. Yeah, that can't be true, right? So some of those 70% have got to be, you know, actually in the bottom 50%. And we can quibble over what average means and so on. But no matter how you slice it, for most of these kinds of traits, people seem to be a little bit overconfident in their own abilities. We did a study, which we talk about in the book, where even in the domain of tournament chess, which is kind of unique in that there's a perfectly accurate rating system in tournament chess. Most people don't walk around knowing exactly what their IQ score is and then sort of delude themselves into thinking that it really ought to be 20 points higher. But in chess, people know exactly what their chess rating is, and they know how the ratings are calculated. So we went to a chess tournament. We asked people in a chess tournament, what's your actual rating? And what should your rating be in order to reflect how good you really are at chess? And one interesting thing was everybody knew what their actual rating was, but most people thought their rating should be higher than it really was. They thought they were underrated. And the ones who were worst at chess thought they were more underrated. So basically, the better you get at chess, the more likely you are to have an accurate conception of your own ability.
And do you think this is true sort of widespread, way beyond – chess is easy to measure, but do you assume that most people think, I really should get that promotion, you know, that guy doesn't know what he's doing, that kind of thing?
Yeah, when cognitive psychologists do experiments in things like chess, it's not because they just care about chess. It's because there's some sort of unique quality of that area which lets us figure something out that would be hard to figure out otherwise. Nobody knows exactly how good they are as a lawyer, you know, or as a office manager or whatever. But I think nonetheless, the same thing would hold. If we could measure exactly how good of an office manager people were, I think a majority of office managers would still think they're better than the average office manager, and probably the worst ones would be the most overconfident.
And is there a rationale for that? Are we trying to protect ourselves? Why are we so bad at looking at the real landscape out there and placing ourselves in it?
Well, there could be a number of explanations for that, and I think that's a really interesting research question. When there's such a widespread finding like this, it really becomes important to figure out why that is. You could argue that there's some kind of advantage to having a positive illusion about your own ability. You know, maybe it propels you further in life. If you think you're better, you're going to try things that you might not do otherwise. Maybe it promotes beneficial risk-taking or something like that. It turns out that people who act confident generally convince other people that they're pretty good at what they're doing. In fact, eyewitnesses are a good case. You know, confident eyewitnesses tend to be believed more than unconfident eyewitnesses. So, you know, confident office managers or confident lawyers who think they're really great at it may actually succeed more because they'll get more clients, they'll get more promotions, whatever. There might be sort of a beneficial feedback effect to it. Confident doctors will be liked by their patients more, and so on. There is some evidence to suggest, though, that if you have a more realistic estimate of your own strengths and weaknesses, you'll be better able to learn and improve. And so there could be some benefits to not being so overconfident, to being properly calibrated.
And there is, I think, I don't know if you call it the American Idol effect, but you kind of see it in American Idol or in America's Got Talent, that so many people believe themselves to be talented and to be worthy of being on a show like that when they are just so clearly not, which is what makes it so funny to watch the auditions.
Well, that's an example of why we study chess, because there's so many other things in American Idol that could be going on, right? They just want to get on TV, you know, so they act goofy. Or the judges are wrong. Maybe there's some people who get rejected who actually are pretty good. But it's those marginal cases in the middle who really honestly seem like they thought they should have, you know, been a finalist but got rejected. Those cases, you know, do show miscalibration. And you sort of think that, like, if those people would think they're not that great, go back and work some more, they could come back and do better.
Chris Chabris, co-author of The Invisible Gorilla and an assistant professor of psychology at Union College in New York, thank you so much for joining us. Fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
And when we return, renowned physicist Brian Greene joins us to talk about how both the Higgs boson and the Mars rover may change our perception of the world around us. Remember that you can find us online at wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can download our podcasts. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.